Okay, so let's unpack this. We're dedicating this entire deep dive to exploring one of the most intensely personal, profoundly sacred, and sometimes, well, sometimes very controversial documents in the LDS
Yeah,
Church.
we are. We're talking about the patriarchal blessing.
Exactly. And it's a fascinating subject, I think, because of the immense weight the church puts on it.
The sources we looked at are crystal clear. This isn't just, a nice bit of encouragement.
Right, it's not a motivational speech.
Not at all. It's explicitly presented as personal counsel from the Lord.
And that specific assertion that this is direct, personalized revelation from God, that's really the foundation of our mission today.
It has to be.
We're taking that claim and holding it up to the light. We're going to measure it against historical evidence, against the church's own modern guidelines, and maybe most importantly, against the real, tangible psychological impact these documents have on members.
Yeah, is it a perfect roadmap from God, or is it something else, something more complicated?
So to start, give us the basic definition. What is a patriarchal blessing or a PB for someone who might not know?
Okay, so PBs are given by specific, dedicated local leaders called stake patriarchs. And according to the doctrine, every single blessing has to contain two main
With
components.
two key parts.
Right, first, there's a declaration of your lineage. It tells you where the 12 ancient tribes of Israel you belong to.
Okay, we'll definitely get back to that. What's the second part?
The second component is really the source of all its power, and like you said, all the controversy. It's the personal counsel from the Lord.
And what does that entail?
It's meant to give you specific guidance, comfort, protection, and it often includes prophetic statements about your future.
So, predictions.
Absolutely. Predictions about your life, your purpose, your marriage, your children, and even your ultimate eternal reward. It's supposed to be a personalized blueprint for your entire existence, straight from divinity.
So for our listener who might be new to this, it's really important to understand the ritual itself, because the whole process is designed to feel incredibly spiritually intense, isn't it?
Oh, completely. Getting a PB is a massive rite of passage. It usually happens when you're in your early to mid-teens.
And the preparation for it really sets the stage. It starts with an interview, right?
You have to go in and speak with your local bishop, and
Yeah.
this interview is all about establishing your worthiness.
Worthiness. So you're confirming you're living all the church standards.
Exactly. You're spiritually clean. You're ready to receive direct counsel from God. The implication there is huge.
Yeah, because if you have to be worthy to get the message, then the moment it's delivered, it kind of confirms you are a chosen, righteous person. It's a massive psychological boost.
It is. And on top of that, you're often encouraged to fast and pray before you go, which just primes the entire experience to feel completely sacred and revelatory.
And the setting itself reinforces that. This isn't happening in a busy church hallway.
No, not at all. You go to the home of the stake patriarch. He's usually this, venerable older man with a very distinct spiritual presence.
So it's intimate.
Very intimate. He places his hands on your head, and the whole setting is meant to just erase the space between the mortal world and the divine.
Here's the absolute core of the delivery, I think. The patriarch speaks as if he is the voice of Heavenly Father.
That's the key. He doesn't say, "I feel like God wants you to," or "I'm inspired to tell you."
No, it's often, "Thus saith the Lord, I declare unto thee." The blessing is recorded. And the patriarch is just the conduit. He's just relaying the message.
An untainted conduit. That absence of a human filter is paramount to the whole claim. It's not supposed to be inspiration, it's transcription. You're hearing God's specific will for your life.
Okay, so let's dig into those two components. First, the lineage. The core belief here is that every member is either a direct blood descendant or is spiritually adopted into one of the 12 tribes of Israel.
Right. It connects you directly back to the Old Testament narrative, makes you a part of that ancient story.
But when you actually look at the data, at the thousands and thousands of these blessings, the assignments aren't very diverse, are they?
Not at all. And the sources point out that the declaration is surprisingly uniform and historically quite loaded.
Loaded is the right word. For the vast majority of members, especially those with European ancestry, the lineage is declared to be Ephraim. It's by far the most common.
Manasseh is the second most common. And historically, Manasseh was often assigned to people of color, though that's shifted a bit over time.
So why those two? Why Ephraim and Manasseh?
Goes back to Joseph Smith's teachings. He taught that these two tribes, the sons of Joseph, were the ones who stayed behind when the other 10 tribes were scattered.
Ah, so they're the ones tasked with gathering Israel in the last days.
Exactly. So Being from the tribe of Ephraim isn't just a bit of trivia. It reinforces this idea that you have a chosen blood lineage preserved by God for a specific monumental purpose.
Building up the church, preparing for the second coming, it gives you an immediate sense of elevated status.
A preordained destiny. You're not just some random person. You're part of the command structure for the end times.
The sources mention other tribes, right? Like Judah or Dan.
Yeah, occasionally someone might be assigned to Judah, especially if they have documented Jewish heritage, or very rarely, to Dan. But the implication is always the same. You have a superior, chosen standing in God's eyes.
So if the lineage gives you status, the prophetic content tells you what to do with that status. Let's look at the actual blueprint, the predictable things that show up in almost every modern PB.
You can pretty much boil it down to the institutional wish list for every member. It is, in a way, a script for compliance.
So what's on that script?
The standard themes are always there. You'll serve a full-time mission. You'll marry in the temple. You'll raise a large or righteous posterity. You'll serve faithfully in leadership callings. And you'll endure to the end.
It's a perfect alignment, isn't it? The patriarch, speaking as God, basically confirms that the church's institutional goals are God's personal will for you.
Yes. It reinforces the idea that a good life is a life lived in perfect sync with the path the church lays out for you.
And for a teenager trying to figure out who they are, that's incredibly powerful. You're not just following rules anymore.
You're following a customized divine roadmap. Compliance becomes a personal covenant with God himself.
But historically, as the sources show, some patriarchs went way beyond that standard blueprint. They got pretty sensational.
Oh, absolutely. Some of these historical promises are just astonishing. The source material cites examples of members being promised they would reach the highest levels of church leadership.
Meaning what? Like an apostle?
An apostle, or even a member of the first presidency. Imagine being a teenager being told that's your destiny.
That sets an unbelievable expectation. And then there are the promises that put you right into the middle of prophecy itself.
The sources mention people being promised that they would become one of the two prophets who are prophesied to die in the streets of Jerusalem in the last days.
Wow. That is the ultimate main character moment.
It is. It's the height of predictive power. It cements your place in the final dramatic chapter of human history. It gives you a purpose that goes so far beyond the mundane reality of your life.
And PBs almost always guarantee the biggest prize of all, the afterlife promise.
This is maybe the most powerful part of the blessing. They commonly declare your certain eternal status. They'll promise you'll be exalted to the highest degree of the celestial kingdom, or that you will arise in the morning of the first resurrection.
And let's be clear about what that means in Mormon theology. Exaltation, the highest degree of the celestial kingdom, that's becoming a god.
It is the ultimate goal, the most coveted prize. And the PB gives you this pre-certified status as long as you stay faithful. It's a divine contract guaranteeing godhood, provided you follow the instructions.
It gives you an incredible sense of security.
Unparalleled. As long as you stick to the roadmap, your success is not just possible, it's assured.
So one last point on the ritual. These documents are intensely personal and very closely guarded. They're often laminated, kept with your scriptures.
And you're not really supposed to share them.
Right. Why is that secrecy so important?
It's an institutional necessity. It's a preventative measure. Because if members did compare them freely, the illusion of this being a custom, personalized revelation would shatter.
Because they'd realize how similar they all are.
Exactly. And, maybe more dangerously, it would highlight the huge difference in the promises. You know, one person is promised they'll be a prophet in Jerusalem, and another is promised they'll be a great primary teacher.
Mm-hmm.
The secrecy masks that uniformity.
It protects the institution from the dissonance that happens when you realize your treasure map looks an awful lot like everyone else's.
To really gauge this claim of personalized divine counsel, we have to look at where it came from and its track record.
Okay, so let's go back to the beginning. The practice started with Joseph Smith Sr., the prophet's father. He was the first church patriarch.
Mm-hmm. And this historical context is really fascinating because the sources highlight that Smith Sr. was known to be a pretty poor businessman. He had a lot of failed ventures.
And crucially, he charged a fee for these blessings.
He did. $1 per blessing.
Which doesn't sound like much now, but in the 1830s, a dollar was a substantial amount of money, especially in the early church, where a lot of people were living in poverty.
It was. So it immediately introduces this transactional element to what is claimed to be pure revelation. The office that's dispensing divine knowledge was also a convenient source of revenue for the founding family.
a spiritual claim married to a financial necessity. But the bigger issue, if we're taking the counsel from God claim seriously, is accuracy.
Right. If they're from an infallible source, they have to be accurate. And the sources are very clear that the early PBs, especially from Joseph Smith Sr., are, and I'm quoting, riddled with a lot of failed prophecies.
And this is where the whole claim starts to run into serious trouble.
It is, because the core failure centers on the single most important event in their theology, the second coming of Jesus Christ.
And we have hard data on this. The sources detail the statistics. Out of the known PBs from the 1800s, 57 of them specifically promised the person they would live to see Jesus Christ return before they died.
And another 51 promised they would witness the winding up scene of this generation.
That is a staggering number of categorical failures. It's a demonstrable prophetic failure that has to be accounted for if the office has any claim to divine authenticity.
I mean, think about it. If God is speaking and 57 people are told they will see the second coming, well, none of them do, the credibility of the entire revelatory claim is severely compromised.
Let's dig into some specific cases from the sources because they make it really personal. Edward Partridge, the church's very first bishop, his blessing was in 1835.
Yes, and he was promised he would live to see the heavens opened and shalt see the Son of Man in the flesh.
But he only lived to be 47.
Right. So his blessing failed on two fronts. First, it also promised he'd live to a good old age, which he didn't. And second, the promise of seeing Christ return in the flesh was obviously never fulfilled in his mortality.
And it wasn't just him. Future leaders got similar, dramatic, and ultimately false promises.
Mm-hmm. Lorenzo Snow, who later became the fifth church president, was told in his 1836 blessing that he had the power to stand in the flesh and see Jesus come in the clouds.
And Wilford Woodruff, the fourth president.
His blessing was in 1837, and it promised he would stand in the flesh and see the winding up scene. These weren't minor figures. They were future prophets of the church, receiving specific, time-bound promises that just failed.
So when you're faced with that kind of clear historical contradiction, how does the institution defend the claim of infallibility? This is where the apologetics come in, right?
It is, and they require a lot of intellectual maneuvering. The defenses usually rely on reinterpreting the language, deferring it, spiritualizing it.
What's the first one?
The first attempt is to claim that the member did see Jesus, but in a very personal, spiritual way. Maybe a vision at the end of their life as they were passing away.
Okay. And the second defense?
The more common one is that the promise was eternal. So it just applies to the next life. They'll be resurrected and then they'll see the events unfold and that fulfills the blessing.
But that feels like moving the goalposts, doesn't it?
It's exactly what it is. Because you have to ignore the plain language of the 1830s. Terms like stand in the flesh before you die, see the Son of Man in the flesh. Those are unambiguously talking about a mortal physical experience in this life.
So if the literal interpretation fails, which it did, catastrophically, the spiritual or deferred interpretation conveniently rushes in to save the claim.
Right. It avoids having to admit that the patriarch, acting as God's designated spokesperson, was profoundly, specifically, and repeatedly wrong about the single most significant event in their entire theology.
And that failure, that specific failure on the second coming, it's foundational. It shows that the individualized counsel from God contained a major testable error, which just compromises the trust in the entire claim.
The institutional church absolutely recognized that this historical pattern of failed sensational prophecies was a huge risk to modern faith.
So what did they do?
Well, the sources clearly show that the modern response has been to strategically water down the blessings. They want to avoid creating that kind of cognitive dissonance and faith crisis for members today.
And we have actual proof of this institutional management of revelation. We have the smoking gun, right? The 2016 church handbook.
Exactly. The instructions given directly to patriarchs. And these instructions are just, they're jaw-dropping in what they imply.
So what do they say?
They explicitly forbid patriarchs from making certain kinds of promises. They're told they should avoid sensational or extravagant promises.
And they give a specific example, don't they? One that targets that historical failure head on.
They do. It says, for example, he should not make references to the timing of the second coming.
Wow. Okay, so that creates a massive theological paradox.
A profound one. If the patriarch is truly a conduit for direct, personalized counsel from an omniscient God, why does he need a bureaucratic handbook telling him what God is allowed to say?
It's like the church bureaucracy has more authority over the content of revelation than God himself. God might want to tell someone about the second coming, but the handbook says, nope, we can't say that anymore. It was too embarrassing last time.
It's the institution managing its prophetic risk. They saw that whenever these men delivered specific, time-bound, testable prophecies, they failed. And those failures created headaches. So to avoid future embarrassment, the sensational content has to be pre-banned by the administrative structure.
And the strategy of managing expectations, it didn't stop in 2016. We saw it just recently in the 2023 General Conference.
Mm-hmm. Elder Yamashita. He essentially gave a talk that created an administrative exit ramp for any promise that might fail in this life.
It was a masterclass in theological caveats, wasn't it?
It really was. He laid out three key points to lower the stakes of the blessing while still keeping its authority.
Okay, what were they?
First, he said a PB is not a map. It won't answer all your questions. Second, if a big life event is not mentioned, it doesn't mean it won't happen.
So that guards against the anxiety of why wasn't my career mentioned or something.
Exactly. And then the third point is the ultimate safety valve. The blessing is eternal.
Right.
Meaning any promises not fulfilled in this life will be granted in the next, as long as you live worthily.
That is the ultimate heads we win, tails you lose argument. If the promise comes true, it's proof of God's word. If it doesn't.
It's not the patriarch's fault. It's not God's fault. It's just that the promises were eternal and have been deferred.
It forces the member into a lifetime of obedience for a reward they'll never see in this life. It's a genius mechanism for member retention.
It is. Because why would you ever stop being active? If you stop, you risk voiding that eternal contract.
Yeah.
The accountability for the failed prophecy gets subtly shifted from the institution onto the individual recipient.
So if the literal promises fail, they become spiritual metaphors. If those metaphors don't work, they become deferred rewards. If the church claims direct revelation but then has to filter it through handbooks and add all these caveats, it really makes you question the honesty of the whole claim. Let's shift our focus to the human toll of all this. Because a patriarchal blessing isn't just a document, is it? It's a personal contract that shapes your identity, your life plan.
It absolutely is. And the sources point to it as a powerful mechanism of control because it dictates expectations around all the major life milestones.
Your mission, your marriage, your career.
And critically, your family size. The pain caused by these unfulfilled promises is often hidden, but it can be immense.
And nowhere is that pain more acute than around family expectations. Mm-hmm. The sources specifically talk about what they call the infertility crisis.
Right. This happens when a PB guarantees a young person choice children and a happy temple marriage, but then reality intervenes. Years of infertility, miscarriage, maybe they remain single or they get divorced.
The expectation planted by that divine guarantee clashes violently with biological and statistical reality.
And the data is right there. The sources cite it. In the U.S., about 1 in 5 married women who haven't had a prior birth struggle to get pregnant after a year. 1 in 4 women have trouble carrying a pregnancy to term. These are common human realities.
But the PB offers this specific, unqualified divine promise that you will bypass all that struggle.
And the guarantee is often so specific and heartwarming, it becomes a rod to beat yourself with later. The source quotes a recent PB given to a woman. Your Father in heaven will send you choice children to raise them in a home, a family home, evening family prayer.
Imagine holding that text, this sacred, personalized message from God, while you're going through years of painful fertility treatments. The cognitive dissonance must be paralyzing.
It is. That promise of choice children and joy stops being a comfort, and it starts being evidence, not of a failed prophecy, but of your own personal feeling.
Which brings us to this key psychological mechanism, blame reversal.
It is the ultimate defense for the institution. When that promise of a perfect, righteous family fails, the child leaves the church, the marriage ends, the infertility persists, the member is immediately conditioned to look for the fault in themselves.
What did I do wrong? Was my faith not strong enough?
Did I neglect the counsel in my blessing? They almost never think. Maybe the 75-year-old man who gave me a boilerplate blessing was just wrong.
Or maybe the whole premise of personalized revelation is flawed.
Right. The focus is relentlessly turned inward. You question your own righteousness or maybe your spouse's worthiness. You do everything you can to protect the sacred status of the blessing itself.
So the PB turns normal, inevitable human struggle into evidence of spiritual unworthiness.
Exactly. Postpartum depression, a child struggling with addiction, intense marital stress. All of these things, when you measure them against a promise of perpetual joy and being an example to others, they feel like personal failures to live up to a divine standard.
If your blessing said you were reserved to lead Israel, but you're currently paralyzed by anxiety, the document implies that you are the weak link. The blessing becomes a self-imposed tyranny.
And the shame is made worse by the secrecy we talked about. You can't easily share your unfulfilled promise or your distress because the blessing is private and sacred. It isolates the suffering. It stops you from realizing that almost everyone else is probably feeling a similar gap between the promise and the reality.
This discussion of uniformity and failure brings us to the elephant in the room, the lack of true customization.
Right. Despite the official claims that PBs are individual promises and custom for every member, we know that when people do compare them, they find that they are, and this is a quote, uncannily similar.
This uniformity is probably the strongest evidence that the patriarchs are working from a template, isn't it?
It really is. They're not channeling spontaneous, infinite divine counsel. They're using boilerplate phrases, a stock catalog of promises, and then maybe inserting small Mad Lib style details.
Like a reference to a talent or a hobby that the patriarch happened to know about the person.
Precisely. And the sources even cite online resources that prove this. Fuller Consideration's Patriarchal Blessings Revelator, for example. It compiles hundreds of these blessings.
And it lets people analyze the text statistically, right, to see the repetition.
Yeah, using heat maps and word clouds to visually show the uniformity. This kind of quantifiable data just shatters the illusion of personalized custom revelation.
When you realize that 90% of your sacred personal message is shared verbatim with thousands of other people, the revelatory claim just kind of collapses.
It forces you to confront the idea that what you received was a tailored version of a generic institutional script.
And sometimes that generic script can accidentally cement outdated or scientifically incorrect doctrine as divine truth.
The sources cite a quote from a 2013 PB given to a modern young adult. You were reserved for 6,000 years for this day.
Okay, that's a problem.
It's a huge problem because it pushes the incorrect literalist doctrine that the earth and human existence are only 6,000 years old. It directly conflicts with overwhelming scientific and geological evidence.
So on one hand, the church is encouraging education, but in a moment of direct personalized revelation from God, the patriarch delivers a statement that's, quoting the source, laughable and horribly incorrect.
It creates a conflict between faith and reality that is impossible to reconcile. If God's specific revelation includes a fundamental error about the age of the earth, why should I trust its guidance on marriage or children? The whole document becomes unreliable.
Let's connect this back to where we started. The source material frames this in a really provocative way. It suggests the PB is like a treasure map, drawing a parallel to Joseph Smith's early folk magic practices.
That analogy is highly instructive
But used for what?
to ensure lifelong customer retention. In the early days, Smith Sr. charged a dollar for a blessing that promised tangible things like buried treasure, but the prophecy failed quickly.
So what's different now?
Now, the modern PB promises the ultimate intangible treasure exaltation, but it defers the fulfillment until the next life.
So you can draw a straight line from Joseph Smith Sr. charging a dollar in the 1830s for a tangible promise of wealth to the modern blessing promising eternal godhood for lifelong obedience.
It's the evolution of a transactional model. In both cases, the member exchanges resources. Back then it was money. Now it's a lifetime of obedience, time, tithing, and loyalty for an incredible but unverifiable future reward.
It's the core transaction of Mormonism. If I do X, then I will receive Y.
Exactly. And because the reward, Y, is always intangible and postponed, the motivation to keep doing X lasts your entire mortal life.
This inherent conflict, this messiness of it all, led to major institutional changes, didn't it? Specifically with the highest office, the Church Patriarch.
Absolutely. The sources detail the bizarre and, for the church, very inconvenient end of the office of the presiding patriarch, the worldwide position that started with Joseph Smith Sr. and was passed down by bloodline.
It was dissolved in 1946.
Yes. And the official reason was very vague, something like ill health for the holder, Joseph Fielding Smith, not the prophet of the same name.
But the sources clarify the real reason.
They do. He was released after his same-sex sexual activity was uncovered.
And this is a critical piece of history. The suggestion is that the church used that scandal as an opportunity to get rid of a bloodline minority that was independent of and could potentially challenge the quorum of the 12 apostles.
It was an inconvenient, high-level authority that had become an embarrassment. They removed the hereditary title to consolidate power and eliminate future reputational risks.
So when we put all of this together, the transactional roots, the historical failures, the bureaucratic editing, the psychological fallout, the source material suggests a really powerful, provocative summary.
Given all the evidence, especially the constant need to defer accountability and manage expectations, the source material suggests the church should operate these blessings with a disclaimer. Something like the one for the television psychic Ms. Cleo.
For entertainment purposes only.
For entertainment purposes only, not from God. To mitigate the pain of the unfulfilled promises and to acknowledge the dishonesty of presenting them as divine, time-sensitive truth.
But if they did that, the entire value proposition would collapse, wouldn't it?
Completely. If the counsel isn't direct revelation, then that profound sense of purpose, security, and the eternal guarantee just evaporates. It becomes, as you said, just a highly personalized motivational speech from a nice old man, not a contract with God.
Okay, let's unpack this for you, the listener. Our deep dive reveals the immense power of patriarchal blessings. They provide purpose, direction, and this deep feeling of divine connection, making the member feel chosen and secure in their destiny.
Mm-hmm. But when you critically examine the historical evidence, like the massive repeatable failure of the Second Coming prophecies, mm-hmm. and you look at the modern institutional efforts.
Like the handbook limitations and the theological next life caveats.
Exactly. When you look at all that, it's clear that PDs are often generic templates, they're heavily filtered by bureaucracy, they're unreliable in their specificity, and sometimes they're deeply psychologically harmful.
So what does this all mean for the member who is holding this sacred text? The dilemma is profound.
It is. It's weighing that powerful, comforting sense of security and purpose the blessing provides against the immense potential for emotional distress and crushing self-blame when the specific literal prophecies inevitably fail or can only be fulfilled through some kind of forced confirmation bias.
It's a huge problem for the church's claims.
It is, because if patriarchal blessings are not genuinely spontaneous, specific, and accurate revelations, if they are just templates filtered by a human bureaucracy to prevent institutional embarrassment, then the core value proposition of having specific, personalized, modern revelation in the LDS church is severely diminished. It calls into question whether God speaks specifically to any of us through these channels if the message requires so much human editing to stay viable.
We've seen that the specific words of God, as delivered through patriarchal blessings, have been shown historically to fail, requiring the church to constantly water down expectations and claim fulfillment in the next life to maintain institutional control. This raises an important question for you, the listener, to mull over. If God's personalized counsel to a single individual must be filtered through a human administrative handbook to prevent institutional embarrassment, who is truly in control of the message? Is it the divine source or the organizational filter?